to In Beta, a semi-regular conversation between physiotherapy educators who are interested in curriculum reform, innovation and critical thinking about teaching and learning. My name is Ben Ellis. I'm a lecturer in physiotherapy at Oxford Brookes University in the UK.
And I'm Michael Rowe, a lecturer in the Department of Physiotherapy at the University of the Western Cape in South Africa. In Beta is an international virtual community that's free for anyone to join. You can find us on Google+ by searching for the In Beta community or using the In Beta hashtag on Twitter.
Okay, so welcome everybody again to today's In Beta session, where we're going to be discussing academic assessment in physio education. And the aim of today is we're not discussing someone's particular piece of work or a kind of set thoughts on this. Really, it's a kind of open-ended conversation that has just come about from some of the bits of thoughts that I've seen other people putting out on Twitter, some of the things that I've been thinking. It's kind of, we're at the point where we've just got to the end. I think I've just uploaded my last mark sheet today. So it's come to the end of that kind of academic period of assessment and marking and all of the work and the stress that comes with that, both from the student's perspective and ours. And it just seemed like a good point to sort of stop, take stock really, and think, what are we doing? And is this actually... is this all a worthwhile pursuit? And I think on some level, we've got to think it is. And so if it is, then how are we going about it? And how can we make it sort of the best that it can be? So I'd kind of posed a few questions on the Google Doc that I'd put out. I'm going to sort of work broadly through those, and we'll sort of see where the conversation takes us really. But I wondered, first of all, if we could just kind of go around and get a sense from the people who are here. The first question I put on there was just what is the purpose of academic assessment? So I'm really trying to draw a distinction here between the clinical assessment. We've talked a bit about that on a previous episode. So I'm really thinking about any assessment that takes place in the university setting. So this could be essays, practical exams, written exams, online exams, all the whole range of things that we do to assess students' work within the academic setting. What's the purpose of that? I'm going to throw that one out and see who would like to come in on that one first.
So I think it gives a nice, I'm thinking at level 4, it gives a good indication for students to understand their performance so far, where they are, what they've brought along with them, and hopefully to identify some learning needs in order to progress further.
Great, thank you. And so you're thinking that, so you said they're about level 4, just to make sure we're all on the same kind of terminology here across the country. So that's kind of at the entry level, year 1, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Year 1 of an undergraduate program. So I think traditionally we've all done that. We might have a conversation later as to the value of it. But the way that we pitch it to students is certainly that in some universities, that level 4 first year is called the foundation level. And I think it could be seen as a useful indication to get people from different backgrounds to understand where they've come from, what they need to do further, so that they're all on a level playing field before they do progress to level 5, year 2 or and thereafter.
Okay, and would you say that, we're kind of getting into that conversation here, so actually I'll park that and come back to it. Michael, you had your hand up. Do you want to come in with your thought there as well?
Thanks. I just wanted to pick up on something that James mentioned. You seem to say that you kind of emphasize the feedback to the students. So giving students an opportunity to evaluate their own progress against maybe some standardized outcome or something like that. And so the flip side of that is, you know, what is the value for the lecturer? And so I just thought that isn't really something that had occurred to me. I wasn't really thinking of it from that perspective. So it's just, I just wanted to comment on the fact that we're talking about assessment, but there's the value of assessment for the teacher, and then there's the value of the assessment for the student. And one of the things I could maybe just add to that is that the assessment for me is a very strong signal that we send to students about what we value. So as a lecturer, the decisions that you make about what to assess, because obviously we're only sampling from a very small part of the curriculum in any assessment, the samples that we choose say a lot about what we think matters. So I think that's something that's always at the top of my mind when I'm trying to set assessments is, you know, what are the signals that I'm trying to send to students?
Well, I was going to say, going back to that first point, often whether it's a multiple choice exam or short answer exam or something, and if it covers a breadth of questions and knowledge, then it is as a feedback method to the academics, it is a useful method to see which bits of the curriculum the students obviously understood and picked up easily, and others where they just didn't answer that question particularly well, and maybe that highlights something where we thought it was blindingly obvious but they didn't. And I think those elements can be a very useful source of feedback to the academics to evaluate their own performance too, because the students have either run with it or they haven't. So it can benefit the academics, I think, as well.
Thanks. Ken, you've just put your hand up in the comments. Do you want to come in there?
Yeah, just to say, I think if you look at purpose, the purpose is learning, but it's also about ticking boxes, obviously for professional bodies, registration bodies, and also for the university. They have academic standards for each level, independent of the professions. So obviously we need to meet those standards. But just back to some of the comments about you know, how it assessment samples just some parts of the curriculum, which I found it's particularly challenging on a sort of MSc pre-reg level because of the way that the credits and assessment load works. So you seem to be able to assess less than the equivalent undergraduate program. So I think it's important to make the point to students that we're not going to assess everything that is important to know. But at the same time, designing assessment tasks so that they don't just have a narrow list of knowledge or behaviours or skills to revise. But I think that's quite challenging too, because you need to be precise about what you're going to assess. But at the same time, you don't want them to give them too narrow a focus of or a part of the curriculum to focus their revision on.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, and it's kind of struck me as something that there seems to be sometimes a tension between the views within certainly our staff is whether or not we should be trying to assess everything. So whether we need to cast our assessment net really broad, and so anything that we might teach could well crop up in the assessment. So therefore, with the concept being that that's encouraging the students to learn everything because they may need to draw on it for their assessment, versus a view that kind of says that's not really necessary, and you know it's not realistic maybe to cover all of those things. But then how if the assessment's very clear from the start, and we get pushed increasingly, and I'm sure this is the same everywhere, to kind of make the assessments very clear right from the start of the course, and so we're already kind of signalling, as Michael said, kind of what we're saying is important. And I know that works on a couple of levels. It's what's content is important, as well as what are the kind of concepts that are important within here that we're actually going to look at. So does anyone have anyone want to let me declare my perspective here. I am not particularly in favour of thinking that we should be assessing everything that we teach. I don't know that that's necessary. I'd rather have a deeper assessment of a couple of things with elements of choice and elements of maybe randomness in there, so that you know we still get that breadth of learning. So there's not a compulsion on the students to have to learn anything. Would anyone want to challenge me on that and say that if I take that approach, that my students are going to kind of target their learning in a much more narrow way and learn less as a result? James, your hand went.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily challenging you. I think perhaps we've all heard students ask us in class, "Is this in the exam?" And I've done some research in terms of accelerated learning and across courses, not necessarily just physiotherapy, but nursing and management on this side of the water and the other. There's a strong sense from students who simply say, tell me what I need to know. And one of the problems with the assessment is that they see that as the hurdle over which they need to jump. So they're no longer reading for a degree, they're simply jumping through the hurdles of assessments. So tell me what I need to know to pass the exam. So I don't think I do challenge you. I think it's we need to make the assessments of interest to them and to offer them as many transferable skills as possible, because you can't assess the whole syllabus or curriculum in any module. It would be too lengthy for them and as a learning process, I'd suggest.
Do you think, because you talked quite a lot when you came in on sort of the difference between maybe a level four assessment and how that might change. So the students coming in year one, we're bringing up that kind of baseline level of knowledge across the cohort. We're showing the students where those gaps might be. Is an approach that is requiring, you know, where the learning is more about knowledge acquisition, is it more appropriate for us to assess a wider breadth of it at less depth, and should that focus of assessment change throughout the program, or does it not really matter where we come in? Should we be taking a similar approach across all years?
Personally, I think we're falling into the trap that if we offer this at level four, then that's we're setting their mindset right from the start that exams are important, that they can't progress without passing exam, and therefore they put all of their focus into the format of the exam, and they ask for ever more prescriptive detail to enable them to be successful in passing the exam, which isn't necessarily an indication of how much they know or what good learners they are. So if we're not careful, we fall into a big trap here.
Yeah, so I think that kind of speaks to, Michael, your point about it, this. We're telling the students what we think of as important. So if in year one we tell them it's really important to learn lots of facts and to be able to parrot those facts accurately back at us, then, you know, we've kind of set that as a kind of standard that we, you know, are going to find it hard to step back from possibly after that point. Do you want to come in on that point, Michael, or you had your hand up on something else?
I definitely agree with James. I mean, we cannot assess everything, even if you believe that that's something that we should be doing. The whole point of the assessment is to try and find a sample that allows you to make inferences about students' performance at a later stage. So essentially, assessment in some sense is about prediction. We're trying to use the assessment that the student is participating in today to try and make some kind of inference about their performance tomorrow. And I think that comes down to the purpose. I think James mentioned, or Ken mentioned earlier, this idea of purpose. What is the purpose of assessment? And as soon as you get to that, we start talking about assessment validity. Are we assessing the things that we say we're assessing? And I think that kind of idea of validity and the confounders to validity are really important when we are designing assessments. If we say that we're going to use this assessment to develop critical thinking, but then we ask the students to list, name, describe in the assessment task, then, you know, obviously there's no validity to the assessment. And so I think a lot of what we're talking about, I think, must be guided by the purpose of the assessment. What is it that we want to achieve, and what are the kinds of predictions about performance that we want to make?
Thanks. I don't know. So, okay, let's go to Joost before I come back in on that one. Joost?
I would like to respond to the question, do we have to assess everything we have to assess? Of course, that depends on the goal of assessment. So when you have summative assessment for credentialing or selection, that's another purpose as assessment for learning. So when I go to credentiality and we see we reflect on the validity of assessment, it is indeed impossible to assess summatively, assess everything, because your students might be some assessment animals hopping from one assessment to the other one and taking the shortcut on learning, and that's what you addressed. So I would like to advocate to advocate a programmatic approach to assessment, and that means that you critically look at the complete program on assessment. So I'd say for each for knowledge, for skills, for critical thinking, for whatever, and then that you would consciously select what you test where, and you don't bother students with them being tested on everything all the time. So that is what my opinion about validity of assessment. So not everything what has been learned, but looking at the complete program of 4 years and then take selection of that, which is, balanced.
Yeah, thank you. So I was really interested by some of the resources that Eustad shared regarding programmatic assessment. Could you just give us a little more of a sense of how that works in practice? So is this something you are implementing or planning to implement, or whereabouts are you with that, and how are you thinking to do it?
Well, we are, Joost and me, we are designing, in this moment, on the first steps to implement programmatic assessment. We have contact with Professor Kees van der Vleuten, who saw his website. Mm-hmm. And what we actually do is, of course, we look at summative assessment, what do we want to assess, but we especially focus on assessment as learning. And that means that in the learning context, you can actually assess everything. You can assess all the knowledge when you use assessment as a learning material. So, more concrete, you start with an assessment assignment regarding, for example, anatomy, but you do it in class.
And at the same time, we have had some experience from the last years with students, and they are, at the moment also, they are involved in this process of implementing, because they really want to have feedback on what they are doing, which direction want to go, because they want to become a physiotherapist. And they want to reach the threshold of our profession. And at the same time, they want to be influenced in their learning space to learn as much as possible. But sometimes they found a little bit difficult to find the right direction. Where are they standing? Where do they have to progress? And that means also that they prefer our feedbacks. But in order to get some feedback, they have to produce or show something. And actually, most of the things that we do, what they show, we assess it in a way, or we provide feedback or feed forward so they can move on, we can enhance. And in the same time, we try now, as Mario just explained, to create a kind of a picture of the student based in different pixels, so that we get more and more an understanding where are they going, where are they standing, where are they heading for the future.
Now this picture, what we are trying to make of the student who is able to become a physical therapist, that's the first picture that we take. This picture is containing pixels of all kind of assessment perspective. That doesn't mean. So coming back to one of the remarks of your colleagues, is for whom actually are we assessing? Now, our opinion is that we are assessing for our students, and of course we assess to evaluate our educational program, but actually we assess to help students unfold. And we don't take, assessment is not only from the perspective of us as teachers, but we use the perspectives of colleagues, students, we use these perspectives of patients, we use perspectives of senior students. In short, we use all kind of low-stake forms of assessment to build up the complete picture. So this picture of the students is enlightened by different assessor eyes.
And so the form that the assessment might take, is the end result of this that you have a higher number of assessments that are all at a lower stake, or do the assessments look much the same, but you're just kind of spreading them out and considering them as a whole, or does it have much of an impact either way?
Well, that's a good question. We strive for much variety in assessments, so much types of assessment, written assessment, performance assessment, video assessment, presentations, all varieties of assessment, and we take it as and use this as a learning material. So the one who exposes his behavior is an example for the rest of the group. So it's learning material, and in the same time, data are sampled to build up this final picture. So you are right. So in the program, let's take it 10 weeks. Students are responsible to be coachable and accessible, what we call it, and so to show themselves and to let themselves being evaluated. So they have the responsibility to offer us material on which we can finally decide for advancing.
Okay, so of all of the assessment that they've done, they then can choose the ones to put forward for the kind of where there is a more high stakes decision to be made about progressing or, you know, completing or that kind of thing. Yeah.
So high stakes decisions, and that's when you look at programmatic assessments, high stake decisions are made on a variety of data. So not on one assessment, but on a collection of assessments. So that's another approach to validity and reliability.
And at the same time, in response to the question of James, we would say that a summative assessment is more kind of a high-stakes assessment. And all the formative assessments are more low-stakes assessments. And yes. Together, they kind of they build up the evidence base. And it's a different directions who slowly starts to point in the same direction. And that's creating the picture, creating the photo of the student. So we're not saying so much as formative and summative assessments.
All material counts.
Yeah. The only point, of course, is that at one point we give the student some credits. So on one point we have to turn all the assessments together, the picture, yes, into credits. And that's maybe the summative part.
And that's a portfolio assessment.
Yeah. Does it make sense a little bit?
Yes, yeah, completely. I was wondering how marking works. So when you're kind of providing the feedback for the low stakes, are you doing, and we can maybe broaden this question then, you know, sort of back out to other assessment formats. Is there a structured way of marking and providing that feedback, or is that quite informal and individual to the student and the assessment that they're undertaking?
You do it both. Of course, we cannot take summative decisions on material which is not validated. So, also the formative assessments sometimes are just feedback, but this feedback has to be sampled and is written down. And sometimes there are scores and feedback. So we use actually the feedback feed forward cycle, so that the student himself can formulate on each assessment his personal learning goals. And so it's not just feedback. This feedback has to be sampled and stored in a database. And we are exploring now how to do that.
Sure, thank you. To ask the question back out to everyone else, then when you're marking, so whether this be presentations, video assessment, essays, practical exams. My assumption is that most people mark to some sort of a marking matrix or a rubric. And I was just interested to know how generic are they? So from people's experience, are people using marking criteria which are generic across a faculty or a department or a program, or individualized ones for each module or each assessment? Just going to throw that question out and to see what people's experiences are of that. Okay, I'll go to Michael and then to James. Michael first.
I was just going to say that I tend to use a rubric. It's quite generic, and it would differ by kind of the, I guess, what it is that I'm trying to achieve with the students. So a lot of the work that I do with students will involve them giving feedback to each other in some kind of online platform. Sometimes it's public. I'm looking for things like digital literacy. So the rubrics across the modules would tend to look the same. So there'd be a weighted mark for content. So obviously, one of the modules I teach is professional ethics. So are the students demonstrating an understanding of the actual content? Then there's going to be a mark for argument. And so I'm going to try and grade how well the students have presented their ability to argue for certain points. So they must present arguments in the form of something like, I believe this because of this. There's a grade for digital literacy. How well have they incorporated various aspects of engaging in online environments? There's evidence. So what kind of evidence have they marshaled to support the claims that they've made? So using that kind of a rubric, I'm trying to make it as generic as possible. But then obviously the details are going to be specific to each module. And then I give different weights, obviously. Content's going to be worth more than the digital literacy component. That's just an example of something that I use.
And so is that rubric, is that one that's used by other people in other modules that they might run within the program, or would they be doing a similar thing and coming up with sort of their own one that would overlap but would be essentially in some ways different?
There's no requirement in the faculty or the department, so it's left up to individual lecturers to do whatever they want. So it's very difficult then to standardize. I would say it's probably difficult to standardize across your assessment regardless, but it's even harder if you're not at least trying to use some kind of a rubric.
Thanks. Okay, I'll go to James. There's lots of hands up, so
I've had experience of both, and being an external examiner at a few other institutions. So the wider generic marking criteria I've experienced, which was faculty-wide, and I suppose the advantages of that would be that students are treated as equally as possible, despite the course that they're on. And they're all aspiring to do well at first year or second year or third year, for instance. And if the honours degree classification indicates something, then I think there is some benefit to be said of generic marking criteria, so that all students could be treated or assessed on an equal footing. There could be an argument that that's unfair across disciplines that are very different, and so maybe as we have so much in common with nursing and allied health professionals, there could be an argument that perhaps faculty should develop the same marking criteria, as I say, so that all students are assessed in an equal standard and format. I've got experience of all modules across the same course having the same criteria, and I suppose the benefit of that is that both students and staff don't need to learn more than one approach, and that as multiple staff do assess across multiple modules, they're not having to learn a new rubric, and equally students don't have to learn a new rubric, and they can understand that the feedback that they get for certain an aspect of their work, they can perhaps more easily understand why they got the mark they did, because it mimics what happened in a similar module in the same year.
And do you think that that works? So I think that that gives the appearance of a standardization. But my, you know, lesser experience would be that maybe what happens is that the interpretation of those. So Michael talked before about kind of the person who might read that the essay and go, well, that's about a 65. And I wonder that no matter how many rubrics and sort of standardized ways that we might try and sort of build in, actually an awful lot of marking still comes back to reading something and thinking that's about a 65 and then working the rubric around to it. And the perception of what a 65 might be for a nursing lecturer marking predominantly nursing assignments and a physio lecturer or someone from, you know, English or somewhere else, even if you were going to go further abroad than that, it is entirely different. And so particularly when you get the more generic the criteria and the rubric, the more broad and possibly meaningless some of the terminology comes within there. So does that take us away from kind of actually aligning the assessment, the marking, the feedback feed forward that we're giving to the outcomes that are specific to that module? That's a very long question, but...
I would agree with you, and I think it might make some sense to the academics, but to the novice student, it probably doesn't. So I'm looking at one now that says that what would mimic something in the 70 or 80% bracket. It's an excellent grasp of theoretical, conceptual or practical elements with an excellent integration of theory, practice, information in the pursuit of the work's objectives. It is very broad and perhaps meaningless to a student at the earliest stages of their studies. So that is the downside of it. So either you paint a brush for all students because they're all studying at the same academic level, but the downside is that it's so broad and generic that it can be very difficult for a student to understand, other than the word excellent is in there.
Yeah, true. Thanks. Okay, Yust, you had your hand up from the previous question too, if you want to come in on any of that or anything else.
Yes, here we are.
Well, we hope that we do understand you well, because actually I wanted to ask, when you talk about generic, are you talking about generic criteria from, for example, the first year to the fourth year on the same construct, say clinical reasoning? Or do you mean generic criteria or different content?
So I'm interested, because I think actually what we're already uncovering is that every institution probably does this differently. So certainly from our perspective, we came up with some generic marking criteria which would cover any form of assessment across any years of the programme. So we looked at sort of five areas around the presentation, be that of practical skill or of an essay or whatever, the knowledge aspects, diversity and kind of person-centeredness, criticality in terms of the thinking skills of the student, and creativity. And then we try to map that onto a kind of inquiry cycle that we'd put together. So we're thinking, okay, what does a student need to know to help a person with whatever they might have? So quite sort of ideas coming from the ICF, those kind of things, and then mapped those concepts onto that marking criteria with the aim of being of coming up with something that would cover a generic range of concepts across a range of different assessments across a range of different years. But equally, talking to other people, then they may have a generic criteria that would fit for any type of assessment on any program within a faculty. So it's probably hard to nail down, because my sense is that actually we're all coming at this differently.
Do you use some kind of taxonomy? From knowledge to critical thinking to creative design as different constructs of assessment, and that's what you call generic, and then you can fill out the content for each module or whatever Is that, do I understand it well now?
Yes, so we were trying to incorporate elements from Bloom's taxonomy into that, yeah. And actually, maybe that's possibly a kind of jump off point there. So one of the things that I put in the preparation document was just a bit of a question around, is there a divergence here between the kind of academic marking we're trying to do? So we might all think around Bloom's and high levels of thinking and levels of analysis and evaluation being what we're aiming to progress our students to and what we are then going to reflect in higher marks versus what we're trying to produce, which is physiotherapists. And we may think, you know, you could make an argument that those higher level thinking skills are inherent to being a good practicing therapist, but I don't know, is there any critique of that position, and is there any sense that actually applying this academic kind of taxonomy of marking criteria that we have isn't necessary, is in some way assessing an entirely different concept to the making of a professional, which is the other role that we have as our courses, and we'd say that's what we kind of set out to do.
I can't comment on that, but that is my personal opinion, but also based on evidence. And so it depends on the one who is assessing, the purpose of the assessment. So I would advocate global criteria for very professional assessors who can look at the total picture, so who have a holistic idea on the student performance. Just like, you know, pattern recognition when you treat patients. They come in, they do something, they say something, they move, and you know what's the problem because you're a super professional. So criteria are very useful to professional assessors, and they are very reliable. There is some evidence I can provide you that shows it is. But when other people are assessing, I say novice assessors or student assessors or co-assessors, you need more specification and more standardization. So, and that's what you know, of course, because they need to know more how to judge the performance observed. So that's the only thing what I can say about this.
Thanks. I think that point is very well made, that often when we're thinking about marking, that there is a range of people who might be doing that. And as you say, there's a difference between the, you know, someone who is an expert to novice. And you can, you know, certainly I've had a sense of some of that when we're trying to mark, you know, there's a difference between being able to look at something and kind of know where the problems are and what level it is at, and then sometimes have to almost retrofit some of that onto a marking criteria, particularly where the broader the marking criteria, the harder it is to reflect what the issues might be. And so for me, I guess it comes round to then the marking criteria is fine, but not that useful for the feed forward. So you end up kind of having to do much more free form feed forward to make the most of the learning opportunity there. That's the time consuming bit, I guess, from the marker's perspective, but it's probably the most useful thing for the student. I don't know.
And at the same time, there's also a kind of a problematic part, I think, that in one way we prefer to assess also content or broad conceptual parts. But at the same time, those concepts don't exist outside our head or outside the head of the student or the learner. So actually, we assess a learner in his or her competence and not as much as the knowledge per se, I would say. That means also there's some kind of variation has to be applied to it. That makes it difficult. So there's variation in the learner, the one who's being assessed, and there's also variation in the assessor. So how can we deal with those? Because the more we think it's completely objective, the more we kind of get a little bit skewed sometimes. So that's always, at least that's the dilemma I always feel, is a kind of a paradox which I have to deal with. And okay, how can I be as honest as possible towards the content, which is a kind of a the standardized threshold for the profession, what people have to achieve, and at the same time, competence level of the learner in which they can progress towards future directions. And that makes it also a little bit hard in this kind of assessment forms. And that means also between Bloom and Miller, for example, what are you doing? Because you always have two things that you have to do, or at least I feel that one I have to do as an assessor.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree. Ken, you've had your hand up for ages, so to prevent any sort of shoulder problems, do you want to come in on this?
I can't feel my hand anymore. It's just my current workplace, University of Central Lancashire. We there is a faculty wide, it might even be wider than that, sort of assessment grid, but it has a is there four domains: knowledge, analysis, application, construction, but then it has a specific category which is free for the module leader to to populate with more specific rather than the very generic. We heard some examples of already statements that perhaps don't make much sense to students and perhaps not even to lecturers. So I don't think there is a best system, but I think these assessment grids primarily serves the internal university purpose. So it is about being seen to be fair and equitable and meeting certain standards. And then you have all these words in there that it's just a sort of gradual escalation of weighting of the adjectives sometimes, and not much else is different. So perhaps the most important category is the one just above the threshold or the pass mark. So it's obviously anything else is different shades of being capable. Obviously, if you're not capable of that minimum pass standard, then you are on the wrong side of that line. And then again, it's just a selection of words to indicate how far below it you are. So but to really make sense of what, for the students, what is required to be on the right side of that pass line, I think it's really useful to have exemplars of what is an acceptable standard, what is an excellent standard, and you know, perhaps what's an unacceptable standard. Obviously, that depends a bit on the assessment format, how easy it is to do that. I was interested in talking about, you use the term academic assessment, and I'm not sure if you include all types of assessments that are performed within university settings, so practical assessments and written assignments, I assume you do.
Yeah. Anything that isn't kind of a practice placement assessment really was my conception of that.
But what about practice placement assessment? And obviously they are assessed as well, and in my experience, the weighting of the assessment varies depending on which university you're in, but they certainly need to be passed. And we use in the northwest of England, we have this there's four or five universities that use a sort of an online system called Online Pair, so a practice assessment record and evaluation system, which is quite substantial, that links to the key skills framework, etc. And I'm aware of a system in Australia that has been validated. There's a common assessment tool used across all universities in Australia and New Zealand. So I'm not sure why, you know, the differentiate. Is there such a differentiation between how you assess university settings, say practical skills, versus in a placement setting?
So no, I don't think there necessarily is. It was more for the so that we didn't stray too much into getting into practice assessment for the purposes of this conversation. But I think your point's really valid. And so I put out a couple of polls on Twitter, which obviously comes with the massive caveat of that they may well be entirely meaningless too. But I was interested by the responses that came back, because I asked a couple of different questions. One being whether or not practice placement assessment should be marked on or not. And I was surprised actually by I thought there might be more support for just having them as a pass or fail. Because you talked about that level of competence. So I think this goes to the heart of Is there a purpose to the academic ranking that we give students on top of that broad, you know, you are now competent, you can go and practice? And you know, as you say, that cutoff line in terms of producing a physio is the most important thing. But it's possibly not the most important thing for the students or for the university. So there's that kind of tension. But what was surprised me, I guess, is that the biggest response by quite a long way was that practice assessment should be assessed and marked contributing to the degree, but alongside something else. So some form of academic assessment should also, when I say academic, I mean kind of, you know, be it a reflective essay or a presentation or something, a clinical reasoning viva, something that sits alongside that, you know, came out really strongly as being the way people thought that should be assessed. But then I asked another question about, what sort of assessment was kind of the most important to be done in the academic setting. And although the biggest answer by far was for a mixed approach, which is, I guess, what we'd all support and expect, for about 50% of people who've broken it down, the biggest number favoured a practical exam. With the smallest number favouring essays. And I've heard this said quite often that kind of, oh, you know, you can be good at writing essays, that doesn't make you a good physio. And that's possibly true. But it seems like we want, everyone sees the practical exams as being some of the most important stuff in the university. But then like a third of the entire course is spent in practice, being assessed in practice. And I just wondered, should we be trying to assess the practical stuff in the university setting, or should we just split these things in two? Should we just have this kind of competence mark, which is being reached through placement, and then kind of be comfortable that the academic stuff is marking additional things, and actually whether or not you get a first or a two, when it says nothing particularly about your competence to practice, it says maybe more around your kind of academic thinking skills, which are the things that these marking criteria tend to kind of lean towards in terms of that weighting. So again, I've gone on a slight ramble there, but any thoughts on that one, Ken?
Yeah, I think sometimes I can see the value of assessing practical skills in a real world setting, because we know the limitations of using fellow students to to practice all sorts of manual or practical skills on when they don't really have any conditions at the scenario suggests, but then we also have the expressed or otherwise demands from the clinical educators that they need to be assessed to be fit to come out and work alongside us. So they need to be demonstrated that they can carry out some of these practical skills before they come and burden us with their presence. It's not every clinical educator has that attitude, but that's certainly something that often comes up. So. It's a difficult one. I think it's much better to have clinical or practical skills assessment in the real world. But I also see the value of preparing students through simulation in some way or form before they go out and meet the real thing. But I think there's a divide between academic or written type of assessments versus practical is perhaps a little bit artificial, and certainly the skills that physiotherapist needs go way beyond being able to do things. So the most important skill, and I think most of the students agree with me on this and my colleagues as well, it is about our communication skills. And unless we can talk to people, unless we can understand how to facilitate behavior change, then however good we are at measuring range of movement or helping somebody get in and out of bed, it's going to be a very low ceiling for how far we can take our patients.
Yeah, I'd 100% agree. But I think, is that the risk of the practical exams in the way that we've tended to do them historically, which are quite reductionist and come down to doing this skill in the right or wrong way, putting your hands in the right or wrong place, and doing it on each other? So actually the potential to really assess communication and those really key skills as part of that process seems pretty limited, I would say, often. Yeah, so it just seems like actually what you can tell about those things from the practical exam done on peers within a kind of university setting seems just so limited and often quite far removed from real practice that I'm just not sure how well they align, even as a mark of competence to go out and try and do this stuff in the real world. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's a valid point. It is difficult to simulate well what goes on in a clinical setting, just within a university practical room. But it doesn't mean, sometimes it is, you know, you have to have basic skills, checklist, safety, hygiene, you know, obtaining consent, all those things. And I think you can assess those effectively in a university setting so that they are better prepared for the real world.
Thanks. I'm going to go back to Michael again, who you had your hand up, Michael, a while back. Did you want to come in?
Yeah, there's so many things that I want to say. But I think I'll limit it to just asking about this idea of ranking and also setting up your cut score. So the idea of kind of publishing your list of students from the top to the bottom. Does anyone do that? I stopped publishing the kind of ranking the list of students a couple of years ago. And now I just give students their individual marks. You know, we say that they're only competing against each other. They're only competing against themselves. So, you know, are you better today than you were yesterday? And then we publish this list that says to the students, no, actually you're you know, right in the bottom third of the class. So that idea of ranking, I just thought, does that have any place? And then linked to that is the idea of the cut score and being set at 50%. Which is completely arbitrary. You know, as long as we are assuming that all items and all marks have the same value, i.e. like a correct answer equals 1 point, whereas obviously some correct answers are more important than others. So, you know, the idea of having an arbitrary cut score at 50% or 60% or whatever you decide to set that arbitrary score as, has anyone kind of given any thought to any alternatives? I know that there are statistical methods for determining the cut score for each individual assessment, but the resources mean that those methods are often only used for the high stakes assessment. Does anyone here have any experience with you know, not ranking students and ranking them against some arbitrary cut score?
Let's go to James.
We definitely don't publish results in that way, that students wouldn't know how they are marked compared to others. I'd suggest there's some data protection elements to that. If we do publish marks, it's anonymously by student ID and not by name. So we purposely don't indicate what actual mark they got in relation to others. My gut feeling is the students would hate it, really.
Yeah, and I would agree that we definitely don't publish a ranking in that sense. But I guess when I was mentioning ranking before, I was almost meaning in terms of allocating, you know, a first, a 2-1. Or whatever that might be, so that there is that, you know, in a sense we rank them into bands rather than the cohort from top to bottom. I think that's probably more common in the UK, definitely. I don't know.
I know of one university that does that, does rank by band rather than specific number, and their rationale for that is that they want the student to read the feedback and understand where they are, feed forward, rather than those students who simply pay attention to the mark and are satisfied or dissatisfied with the actual mark. So, no, I agree with you. There is examples in the UK where students aren't told their actual summative mark until much, much later on in the cycle.
And do we all think that it's a good thing that students leave with a degree classification? So above and beyond the kind of baseline level of competence, you are now fit to practice. What's the added benefit of having then a first, a 2-1, or however the degree classification might be presented in other countries. What does that give on top of the competence, do you think? Michael?
Is that rank reflected in their transcript? So in other words, would it be reflected in any job interview that they go for?
So, I mean, that would be the degree classification that they had. So they would definitely apply to jobs with that. So yes, although commonly what you would hear is things like people saying, oh, well, a student who got a first is maybe not the best practical physio anyway. Maybe they're too academic. You know, these kind of ideas have been out there in the past. I think it's possibly changing now because more and more students are getting first. So it becomes harder to kind of keep that logic going, I guess. But yes, it would be something that they would use. And not only for sort of job interviews, but also, I guess, coming back into higher education, doing master's, PhD, then obviously those academic conventions of the grade you got do matter in those senses. But I just wonder if does it detract sometimes from the idea of what we're just trying to produce, which is a competent practitioner. James, yeah?
I think the difficulty for them is that we've already noted that some universities create the degree classification by different modes. Is it all academic work? Is there an element of the practice placement experience? So at my institution, we include practice placements as part of the final mark, the final number that would lead to their honours degree. And therefore, it's a mixed playing field, isn't it? Although someone who turns out with a first, does that mean that they came from a university where only the academic work was assessed and they got a first from writing essays? Or was it from a university that did incorporate a clinical placement element to it as well, in which case it reflects their clinical expertise as well as their academic expertise? So it's a difficult one because how would an employer know what that first actually relates to?
And I'm not entirely convinced that the employers care. I'm not sure it's something they're obviously looking for someone who is able to practice, so has their HCPC registration if they're in the UK or whatever the equivalents are internationally, and that seems maybe more important. I was interested, Michael, you said that there is no rank or grade on your degree. So students just either achieve the degree or not. Is that right? Have I understood that correctly?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so there's no differentiation between someone who passes a degree with an average mark of 52 versus someone who passes it with an average mark of 78. That they both just get the same outcome.
I know that at the graduation, they announce students who graduate cum laude or summa cum laude, but I don't know if those are reflected on their degree certificate.
Wow, interesting. And do you think, so not having that system, would there seem to be any benefit of introducing it?
If I think about, if I was an employer interviewing people, I don't know if that would mean anything to me. And I know that when I was one of the few times that I interviewed for a clinical position, the person, the head of the practice, said she doesn't care what mark I was or what experience I had. All that she wants to know is, am I going to fit into her team? And that was based on the conversation that we had. So not having been in a situation where I actually am responsible for hiring someone, I'm not sure, but I'm guessing that it's not really something that I would pay much attention to.
And I see that you've also come back and say in the Netherlands that you also provide a degree certificate without grades on. So for Michael or for you, then does that have any noticeable impact on the students' kind of orientation towards grades? So if the outcome is the same, it's not going to say anything different whether or not their average is in the 70s or the 50s. Are students still orientated towards getting higher grades? Or do you think that takes the kind of pressure off from that sense?
I think students only care about grades. So it doesn't, you know, in my experience, it doesn't matter how much I try to kind of reduce the kind of relative importance of grades. The fact is that if you don't get more than 50% for, you know, all of your modules, you're not going to graduate as a physio. So,
you know, I'm cutting across you, but so obviously the grade's important in terms of achieving a pass versus a not pass, but beyond the pass, is there a, you know, would your students mind if they got a 68 instead of a 72? Would that concern them particularly or not really at that level?
It depends on the student. I think you've got some of those students who are really driven and motivated, and they're going to, you know, come back and argue for getting that one point on that one exam, even though, you know, statistically it's not going to move their average at all. And then there's the other student who's, you know, pretty happy to just get his pass mark and then all the variations in between. So I think it all depends on the student about whether or not the mark is important and how well they rank. I just wanted to say earlier, I talked about not kind of posting the marks of our students. And that's something that is pretty standard across all South African universities in all faculties. So at the end of each assessment, the lecturer will post you know, a piece of paper with student number and the grade that they got for that assessment. So it's supposedly anonymized because the students' names aren't there, but you know, over time you know who's who. And so that's pretty much standard practice in South Africa.
Okay, interesting. And do you give feedback through kind of things like Turnitin and those kind of electronic ways of marking? And
so I'll tell you what I do, and just bear in mind that I don't know of any other people who do it this way. So the way that I run most of my assessments is that prior to the final submission, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, the students have to complete a draft, and they submit the draft, and I do peer feedback and I give feedback. So we mostly use things like Google Drive or a blog. You'll post something and I will allocate 3 other students to give you feedback. I coach the students on giving each other feedback, and I coach them on how to give constructive feedback. So the feedback is not just saying, this is what you did wrong. The feedback is all about, and this is what you need to improve. And then I go in and I give another round of feedback on top of that. Most of the time, by the time I get into it, the students have already given each other most of the feedback that I would give. So I'm not commenting on things like, you know, referencing and what content is missing and how they need to improve it. I can give a little bit more insightful feedback, and that cuts down on the amount of feedback that I need to give, because the students, you know, mostly cover it themselves. And then the students will use the feedback because it's completely dissociated from the grade. So they use the feedback in order to improve the grade. So when you separate the grade from the feedback, then there's an incentive for the students to pay attention to the feedback because it helps improve their grade. What most people do is they obviously, the feedback is linked to the grade. The students only care about the grade, so they ignore the feedback because the tasks aren't iterative. So unless your next task is going to follow on conceptually from the previous task, then there is no incentive for a student to pay attention to any of the feedback. So that's something that's how I manage feedback. I don't, there is no feedback given with the final grade. So that's just something that I do.
Great. And do you find you have to chase the students to, you know, to provide each other feedback? Is that any sort of a practical issue there, or does that happen pretty swiftly and smoothly?
There's a small mark allocation for the feedback. So when they graduate, they will have to give feedback to novices. We have a system called community practice where every physio that graduates has to spend a year doing community practice for the state. And in that time, they will be supervising students. It's kind of low level supervision and really just kind of handholding. But, you know, I say to the students, your ability to help each other improve is going to be necessary once you graduate. Your peers are going to be expecting feedback from you. So this is a way for you to practice giving constructive feedback. So there is a mark allocation to the feedback, and I link it to some of the objectives in the modules.
Great, thanks. I'm conscious of the time. It's quarter past three, and we've been talking for over an hour already. I'm going to propose that we continue going just for another 10 minutes or so, if people are sort of happy with that. But if people need to leave, then please feel free to. But it seems like there's still some points that we're talking through here, so we'll carry on. And Ken, you had your hands on, so I'll hand up, so I'll go to you.
Yeah, thanks. Just a question for you, Michael. Just for those students providing peer feedback, are they from a different cohort, an older cohort?
So I've done this a couple different ways. Lately, I've actually been doing it with international cohorts. So I do some collaborative work with colleagues in Norway, Brazil, and Bangladesh. And so we have students from different countries giving each other feedback. That's very handy. And then I've tried it with giving students feedback from different cohorts. It becomes a little bit problematic because of the way that the university is kind of marking infrastructure is set up. It's very difficult for me to allocate marks to students in a different cohort who are taking a subject that I'm not the allocated lecturer for. If I don't require them to give the feedback and link it to a grade, then they're less likely to give it. So it's difficult. But I must say that the international feedback has been working really well, and those are usually students in the same cohort. I'd love to have some kind of a system where we had a mentorship program where we've got the kind of more experienced students giving feedback to the lower levels. It's been difficult to sort out, but I'd love to be able to do that.
That sounds really interesting. I really like the idea of using international connections to give feedback across the borders. It's a great idea.
Great. Has anyone else used formative feedback in a similar way? Or I really like this idea of shifting the feedback and the feed forward onto the formative assessment point and reducing it at the summative. And I completely agree with the reasons that Michael gave for doing that. I just wondered whether anyone else had tried anything similar or come at formative assessment in a different way. Okay, Ken, go for it.
We have sort of very strict criteria from the university as to how we give feedback, summative feedback. So it has to be for written assignments. We use Turnitin online, and they even stipulate how many comments per page of assignment we need to provide. And then we have audio feedback up to 3 minutes as well. So it's quite prescriptive. So clearly the institutional thinking is that student learn from that feedback given on summative assessment, typically end of module. But I think it's like Michael had been saying, and it's much more useful for the students to get that feedback as part of formative assessment to inform the summative, rather than to get it at the very end, which they often don't even look at because they only look at the mark.
Yeah, I think it's probably one of the most frustrating things when you can see how many students have actually accessed the feedback given, and you know it's less than 50% of the cohort. You know, when you've spent those evenings, you know, putting everything else to one side and you know writing, you know, often quite lengthy feedback. You hope it goes somewhere, but I completely see it from the student's perspective, as Michael said, that there's why would they? What's the incentive? If this isn't a sort of iterative process, that, or they can't make that link of it being a sort of iterative process. And let's face it, it's pretty hard to take quite specific feedback we might give about for one particular assignment, and then be able to apply that to another possibly quite different style of assessment, or even know that you're going to be doing the next assessment, which is going to be marked by someone completely different, and you kind of know within the faculty team that actually the way of marking is going to be quite different. And so I think anything which can sort of shift the shift the feedback, the feed forward to become a real learning opportunity, moving it onto the formative seems really helpful. Rina, you just popped your hand up, so I'm going to come to you on that one.
Right, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. Lovely. So apologies, I was late today, but really enjoying the discussion and really interested in this around the summative feedback, because I do give extensive summative feedback, but that doesn't necessarily translate into an improvement in writing for the next piece of submission. In terms of the formative process, what I do is they submit a paragraph and a plan, which I then offer feedback in terms of their plan and look at their writing style within the paragraph. I'm interested in actually this idea of doing formative feedback for the draft essay. So actually having a look at a whole piece of work, and previous to now, I've always been under the impression that we can't do that, that we can't look at a whole piece of work. And by doing so, we're giving students too much support. So I just wondered what your thoughts might be on that, Michael.
I always kind of think about it in terms of, you know, what is it that I'm trying to achieve with the assignment? At the end of the assignment, I want to be able to say, well, these students have demonstrated competence in A, B, and C. How they got there is kind of part of the teaching and learning process and relationship. What matters to me is that they walk away from the assignment having achieved the objectives that we said at the beginning. And so for me, the fact that they're getting, in most cases, it's three rounds of feedback from students. And between those three students, they're going to get a pretty good kind of collection of comments that are going to be useful. Then I come in at the end, I give bits and pieces where I feel that the students have maybe missed out. The students are seeing, so, you know, a wide variety over the course of the year. They're seeing a wide variety of different assessments from different students at different levels. They can evaluate their own performance against those students. So now they start to understand what good looks like. So I don't have any students coming to me saying, I only got 65%. I think I did good work. Why didn't I get a higher mark? Now they're actually seeing that whole range of competence. And so the student who's 65, yeah, he knows why he's getting 65. So I think exposing the students to the entire assessment, it really ticks a lot of boxes for me in terms of what I'm trying to achieve with helping the students improve their learning.
Yes.
I don't think it's a case of telling them everything that they have to do. The other thing that I think about is my own writing. When I'm finished a first draft of a paper that I want to submit, what do? I send it to a colleague and I ask them to give me feedback. The reviewers who help me improve the paper for the final publication, they see the whole thing and they give me feedback on the whole thing. I think for someone who works a lot in public, and who gets feedback on a lot of work before kind of the final piece is complete, I like to introduce students to that same idea that it doesn't have to be right. It doesn't have to be perfect. You can send this thing out for feedback, you know, before it's ready. I just think that there's a lot of parallels between what we ask, or there should be a lot of parallels between what we ask students to do and what we as academics expect for ourselves and our own development.
Yeah. That's a fair point, and I can see why by doing that they have to engage with the marking process a lot more and the criteria, and I can see the value that would then have for future pieces of work. Do you have any issues around compliance or some students not engaging with the process?
I do assign, I think, 5%. It's a very low value in terms of the total assignment, but I give the students a grade for the quality of the feedback that they give each other. And so they know what it's a basic rubric that kind of they can use to make sure that the feedback that they give each other is kind of relatively high value, I suppose. And even if you assign a small value to the grade, you know, that's worth something to the students.
So I think it's probably a good point for us to sort of wrap the conversation up for now. I think there are still things that we haven't got to, and I think we could definitely consider having a part two on this. maybe coming back having thought about some of this. So yeah, I think having a part two would be good. So we will set a date for that. So yeah, cheers.